Okay, thanks very much, Antoine. Well, my thanks to the organizers for giving me the chance to come here and get sucked dry by you guys a week long. I hope you can get enough sustenance from me before you cast me back as a dry shell back to Amsterdam. So what's really prepared and what's going to run smoothly, I hope, now that the projector talks to the computer, is this talk about angle result photo emission. I've got a bunch of other stuff sitting in the laptop in various degrees of readiness, which maybe decreases as we go down this list. And if you see things here you may be interested in, some of it's a bit older, some of it's a bit newer, just come and tell me what you think the most interesting bits are, and I can try and generate something to we can discuss about. So now it's going to be about angle result photo emission, but it's part of a larger program I've been involved in Dresden in the last almost 10 years, since 1 year I'm in Amsterdam. But of course, you can do many other things in spectroscopy than just take an electron out. You can add an electron, for example, from a core level in X-ray absorption. You can take a core level electron out and look to see how the electronic system screens that perturbation. You can use electron energy loss spectroscopy to look at the dynamics in Q space of gap excitations in insulating cuprates. And you can also look at the whole zoo of transition metal oxides, how covalence and valency goes hand in hand in those kind of systems using also X-ray absorption. So that's the kind of stuff we've been doing. But today it's going to be purely ARPAs. So high TC superconductors, angle result photo emission, of course, gives you the view from K-space. That's my title of today's talk. So as I want to stress to you, most of the work I'll be presenting today was done in the group in Dresden while I was there in the last few years, and some of it's been done by my old group since I've left in collaboration with me in Amsterdam. I'm busy setting up a new laboratory at the moment. I'm very happy for the very collegiate collaboration with my old friends in Dresden. So there's a whole bunch of people involved in this work. Don't expect you to read all these names real time. The important people get a yellow box. These three guys in Dresden, Sergei Borisenko and Sasha Kordyuk, two very highly motivated and skilled postdocs. And Sergei is now a staff scientist in Dresden, doing much of this ARPA's work. Andreas Koich, a young grad student, joined in the last year or so. Yingtai Huang is in my group in Amsterdam and is a traveling solvent floating zone crystal grower, which of course is quite an important friend to have if you're doing spectroscopy. Other crystals of the lead dope 2212 came from Helmut Berger in Lausanne, really excellent crystals then grown via the melt. Of course, the money is at the bottom, but you guys aren't giving it to me, so I don't need to go into that in big detail. So ARPAs is, as well, to come here, you're paying me, I'm very happy, but I don't think you'll report back. Sasha saw the form, and it's important that he tells them whenever they ask him that I think they're great. Angle result photo emission as K-space microscopy, so I'll just introduce the technique briefly to you. Of course, you probably know it all, and if you're really bored, just shout, and I can go a bit faster. It's good that we all at least have the same understanding of the nomenclature that I'll use to describe the data in the rest of the talk. And then it's basically going to be about results from the BISCO family of high TC. I will motivate why it is BISCO that has become the Drosophila for ARPA studies in these systems. I'll talk about the simple thing to start with. It's a somewhat older story, maybe it means it's about 2 years old. About the Fermi surface in these systems, there was a brief flurry of excitement that we didn't know the Fermi surface topology in these systems, which I'll show you now, is quite clearly settled. I'm allowed to make such horrible puns at Shakespeare's expense as I come from England, though Mike will probably kill me later on. I won't cover the doping dependence. That's hanging on the bottom of the PowerPoint presentation. If I have time and you want to see it, I can bring that. That will probably give way to some newer data on the superconducting energy gap in 2212 and a whole bunch of stuff about a subject dear to all photo emission people's hearts, but it's actually more important than such jargon as peak dip humps. It's really about whether we can see strong coupling effects in the angle result photo emission of the high TC, firstly in the overdoped regime, and secondly then in the underdoped regime. Okay, so high TC and their parent compounds, I'm preaching to the choir here. We know they're not ordinary metals, they're not ordinary superconductors, so of course we need to understand what makes their electron systems tick, and you need two things to do that. This is really preaching to the converted. Of course you need theory to try and understand these things, but theory without some people from experiment to go hand in hand is, of course, a loose cannon, in my opinion. So, as is experiment without theory, so we need each other here. And it's experiments such as spectroscopy, which offers a very nice interface between the theoretical world and the experimental world. So I'll try and sell you the fact that spectroscopy, such as angle result photo emission, offers a very nice direct probe of the electronic states, which are really doing the superconductivity, and has become a kind of litmus test for people fine-honing their theoretical tools on such systems as the HITC. So I think there's a lot of synergy here in that workshop, and the fact that you invite experimentalists here shows that that's an important way to go. So you can do, as I said, lots of things with electrons. These are boxes with electrons in. These are boxes without electrons in. So you can kick electrons out, that's photoemission. You can kick core electrons out. You can put electrons in. You can excite electrons. Don't need to worry about that today. I will just start on the left with photoemission. It's very simple, photon in and electron out. So it is important to remember that we have an ionized final state. So we're actually looking at the electronic states of the N-1 electron system, which of course for a collated system doesn't have to be the same as the N-electron system. So, ARPAs. Well, ARPAs and HITC, I did my PhD just at the beginning, so a couple of years after HITC started. I started as a naive PhD student trying to do my best with what was then possible in the United Kingdom in terms of photoemission instrumentation to make a contribution to this game. And what was obvious to me, even at that tender age, was that the love affair between ARPAs and HITC got off to a very sticky start, actually. I mean, the traditional superconducting community are people who like to stick wires on things, put their samples in a cryostat, and measure maybe with magnetic field as a parameter. So ARPAs was very much seen as something pretty cranky. You're really quite perverted to try and do serious physics with ARPAs. That was the view, at least, in the late 90s. So it measures some kind of rubbish on your surface. That's, of course, a big problem if you're not aware of how to deal with that. And of course, ARPAs can only give you the high energy scale. You can never get to the low energy physics that you would see in transport. Well, because of the pull coming from the science community, especially in the HITC, ARPAs itself has developed so far that now really it's become one of the most powerful tools for looking at the low energy scale of the HITC superconductors. So it's a K-resolve tool. That's, of course, its big advantage, for example, over optical spectroscopies. So you can look at the normal state electronic structure, the normal state Fermi surface. You can look at gaps resolved in K-space, either normal state or pseudo-gaps or superconducting gaps. You can, because of the very improved energy and momentum resolution we have nowadays, get a handle on interactions between the electrons themselves, in between each other, and also with other modes. You can get a feeling for the lifetimes, which are then going into the low-energy transport measurements. So we're not, of course, at the energy scale where we are really sensitive to the same scattering rate as in transport. That's still a few years around the corner, but we're not very far away. So I'd argue that we're really looking here at the low energy scale of the problem. And as I said, that means that angle-resolved photoemission has now become a very well-accepted technique and is an acid test for theories. Well, how do you do it? It's very simple. It may cost quite a lot of money, but the concept is quite simple. We have monochromatic light source, so this can either come from a synchrotron source or you can have a laboratory source, which of course limits you in terms of which photon energies you can have. You need a very good single crystal. Without that, the money on the spectrometer was wasted. And what you're basically doing is illuminating the surface of this crystal with your monochromatic light. Your photoemitting or your electrons are excited by these quanta of usually VUV radiation, that means a few tens of electron volts, up into the soft X-ray regime, and we measure then with an electron energy analyzer, which is more or less a capacitor type of system. We measure the energy spread of these photoelectrons coming out in angle-resolved photoemission. We do that at a particular emission angle with respect to the surface normal, so here called theta. So you need single crystal, you need monochromatic light. The fact that the photoelectrons, which are generated till quite deep in the crystal, have a very high probability that they suffer inelastic scattering on their way to the surface. That makes photoemission surface sensitive. So that was what puts the price tag on this kind of spectroscopy. You need ultra-high vacuum so that when you've generated a clean crystal surface, it should stay clean for, let's say, of the order of 1 or 2 days, or at least 12, 13, 14 hours, depending on how sensitive you're measuring. And that means that the signal you're seeing is really the signal of the photoelectrons escaping from the first few unit cells of your crystal and not ones which have been interacting with some crud sitting on the sample surface. So often, of course, we're dealing here with measurements at low temperatures, so if you're not careful, you will have residual gas atoms adsorbing on your surface. So a certain amount of surface science know-how is necessary to do it, but as I'll show you later, in some of the HITC systems, we're very convinced that we're really sensitive to things which are intimately involved with the volume electronic structure. So the way of doing ARPAs, which I got to know as a grad student in the late 80s, was called band mapping. So you either rotate your sample, or usually then you had a small energy analyzer on a goniometer, and you just measure one particular beam of photoelectrons, so you have two little narrow holes between your sample and the energy analyzer, and then you rotate the analyzer a bit and you measure again, and what you notice, if you have a nice cleave and well-behaved electronic states, that you have here a peak in the photoelectron spectrum, so it's a photocurrent, versus here's binding energy, which we can calculate back, of course, from the kinetic energy we've measured of this blue beam here. And as you change the angle, this guy moves. And so what you're actually doing here is mapping out the electronic band structure, because this angle is related by this very simple relationship here underneath. This emission angle is related to the component of the wave vector parallel to the surface. So if you're dealing with a system where K perpendicular is not a really dominating component, and that's certainly the case in the high-TC superconductors, then you have a very nice direct handle on the value of K perpendicular in your system. Well, nowadays we do it a bit differently. The idea is exactly the same, the formulas are exactly the same, it's just the instrumentation has got rather better. So now we have analyzing systems which enable the simultaneous examination of the energy distribution of the photoelectrons and the angular distribution, which means, of course, the momentum distribution. And the kind of numbers of the system which will arrive in Amsterdam at the end of the year are energy resolutions of the scale of 2 millielectron volts with simultaneously angular resolutions of the scale of 0.1. And when I started my graduate thesis work, you were very happy if you had here 2 degrees rather than 0.1. And I'll show you that's actually a real quantum leap in terms of what we're able to save from angle-resolved photo emission. So interesting, in Amsterdam, what we do is a thing called angle scan photo emission. To get this kind of performance, your energy analyzer weighs about 70 kilos, and you don't want to try and rotate that around the sample, unless you know some friendly guys who are used to sending missiles to Russia. They can do it very well at Lawrence Berkeley Lab, but in Amsterdam, we can't do that so simply. So what we do is we rotate the sample instead. So you call this angle scan photo emission. You have to build yourself a fancy sample manipulator with some motors that talk to some computers, and you can set the sample dancing in front of this, the nose of this analyzer with your light beam on. So what we have is a system which allows us to vary the sample temperature. That's trivial, though doing it at low temperatures is not trivial. We have rotations around these two main angular axes. This one here we call a polar rotation, so it goes through the sample surface, actually not through the center of the sample. And this one here is azimuthal rotation around the sample normal. And the important point is to be able to do those rotations at low temperature with the same degree of accuracy that you've bought with hard-earned euros in your analyzer. So you need a very precise mechanical movement of the sample, and then you can just do angular mapping of the photo emission intensity. So that's where the word angle scan comes from. It's a Swiss invention, if you like. The group Philip Abey are the first people who started this method of doing angle-resolved photo emission. It's a very powerful one.
I wouldn't restrict the temperature. Can you go to lower temperatures, or is there something?
These are basically with continuous flow helium cryostats. You have a bit of the problem that, of course, you need a quite open area at the end, the bottom where your sample is, in order to be able to get your light beam in and your electrons out. And you also need quite a, to get all this rotational freedom. In here, the cooling is done with a copper braid coming from a cold finger, and generally you're not going to get much lower than this. So I don't see the possibility in the very near future of people getting dilution fridge sort of temperatures with photo emission. That's going to be really quite tough. And if we can really measure at 5 Kelvin, that's what we're aiming at now, we're very happy.
How about higher temperatures? Yeah. Does that pose a problem?
Depends what you mean by high. I mean, a few hundred.
Like transport measurements that extend up to 600, 700 degrees.
K or C?
Kelvin.
K. Yeah, that should be possible. I mean, usually the materials we use are all laid out for the low temperature side. You probably have to modify the bottom part of your cryostat to be able to take those high temperatures. Everything is bakeable. So that means 200 C is always okay. So let's say 500-600 Kelvin, that really has to work.
You don't have a problem with your vacuum?
No, in addition, it's all clean. So if you heat up clean stuff, it shouldn't stink too much.
Makes sense.
How clean the samples are, of course. You don't want to lose oxygen. I mean, you certainly couldn't be very careful heating up high TC to 300 C or something in UHV. You have to be careful that you're not changing the oxygen content. That's one thing, of course, which is different to something else. So of course, if you go to the synchrotron to get your red wiggly snake here, your photons, you have significant advantages. You have a very high intensity with a low bandwidth, so high resolution source. You have variable energy, which I think I'll show you is a very important part of working out what the hell you're doing in this game. And you can also have nowadays variable polarization. So that's actually a big advantage of doing it at the synchrotron. Now, if you're trying to get funding for this, the points you make are, let's say we're getting to about 5 Kelvin. Of course, this is a question of resolution and temperature. You need to match them with each other. So the thermal broadening is, roughly speaking, 4 kT. So 4 kT at 5 Kelvin is about this 2 millivolts. So we're matched between our energy resolution and temperature. We could have 30 millikelvin, let's say, in a dream, but then we would need to get this one down an awful long way. So these need to go hand in hand. And just to give you an example of what this angular resolution means, if you're dealing with 20 eV photons, this means less than 1% of the Bruin zone edge. Okay, so when you're going for money, you don't call it ARPAs, you call it case-based microscopy. So you really have a probe which can move in very small steps in reciprocal space, looking at the frequency dependence of the elementary excitations. And a price ticket on something like this is about, yeah, well over $1 million at least for something like this.
Per K point.
Per K point. Well, if you have lots of K points, you get a a rabat, as they say.
It's not less than this size.
Okay, so I'll give you an illustration of the kind of things that have become possible with the improved instrumentation. We'll just take the nodal direction of 2212 as an example. So what you have is this analyzer. At the end of the analyzer, you have a two-dimensional detector, and what it gives you is in one axis a little bit of angular space. It's 14 degrees in the Dresden system, which corresponds to this much in reciprocal space, about 0.5 reciprocal angstroms. In the other direction, you have a certain proportion, one-tenth of the path energy. That's the potential difference between these capacitive spheres, half spheres, in your analyzer. So you have a little bit of energy, and you have a little bit of momentum dropping onto your detector all at once. And this is a big advantage that you can then just slice this signal up. So this is what it looks like. This is the electronic states in the nodal direction. So it's the energy distribution and the momentum distribution. And the third direction is the photocurrent, so the intensity. So what we're used to doing is looking at energy distribution curves or photoelectron spectra. That's the only way we could do it before we had these very good momentum resolutions. So then we're cutting this data set in this direction here. So I'll just let it scan through, moving along in momentum. Each of these in the old days would mean the grad student like me then would move the analyzer maybe a half a degree and measure another spectrum, move the analyzer half a degree. That all comes now in one big blob on your detector, and you can slice it up electronically. So we're moving here from the occupied side towards the unoccupied side. So we're going from inside the Fermi surface barrel, if you like, towards the gamma point from pi pi. What you see is your state growing in intensity, getting narrower and narrower, and dispersing towards the Fermi level. So here you can just do normal standard band mapping. You could just identify the maxima of these energy distribution curves, put a little red blob in each of these, and make an E versus K plot. So this blue spectrum is, of course, an important one. This is a spectrum where the band is really at the Fermi level. So this is, in fact, we've identified one single KF point for your $1 million in this high-TC superconductor. If we go further, of course, the intensity drops down very suddenly because this band has moved off into the unoccupied states, so we can no longer ionize it. Still there, but we can't do it with photoemission spectroscopy. So one of the things in the energy distribution curves of the high TC, which still remains a mystery, is this, for example, here we're in unoccupied states, but you still see intensity. So there's this strange step-like background, which you see almost everywhere in K-space. And there are people who believe, I'm sure, with a certain degree of truth, that there's a lot of physics in that background. It's just very difficult to get it out. Other people say, well, let's just pretend it's not there and subtract it away. That's probably dangerous. So we have in the energy distribution curves a line shape which is not trivial to understand. There are various theoretical approaches being developed to describe this line shape, but nobody agrees about them in a sort of broad consensus, whether they're reasonable or not. Of course, what you'd like to analyze is things like the width of this structure as a function of frequency to try and get some idea about the imaginary part of the self-energy, for example. But that's very tricky because as soon as this peak, as soon as this band gets close to the Fermi level, it starts to get guillotined by the Fermi-Dirac distribution. So you have to take that into account. So it's actually quite a tricky quantity which we had at our disposal at the beginning of high TC.
Is that optimally doped?
This is overdoped, in fact.
Overdoped.
Though how sharp and nice this looks is purely a function of momentum resolution, because this band is dispersing very strongly. And if you took the old momentum resolution of a few years ago, then it would look like maybe one of these curves here, because it's just you have a finite K window through your angular resolution. And if it's dispersing strongly, its width here is actually totally dominated by the K resolution, not by the energy resolution, in this point in K space. So you have to always, as experimentalists, look which way my band's dispersing most strongly to see which of your knobs you need to screw right down to get a narrow structure. So the other way, of course, to look at this is to cut this data in this direction. That's a momentum distribution curve. So I take a constant frequency, let's say zero, the Fermi energy, and I just plot a graph showing the intensities for all of these, the same energy for all different momenta. So that's then cutting it in this direction. I'll show that on the other side. We start down here in the unoccupied states, so it's flat. We're measuring here, this is at 120 Kelvin, so here we're above the Fermi level, but of course you still see intensity because the Fermi Dirac distribution has a finite width, so you can follow states up into the unoccupied or the thermally occupied region with a momentum distribution curve. And the red one here is the analog of the blue one here. The red one is the momentum distribution curve for energy equal to the Fermi energy. So if you like, that's the cut along this orange ball, up the mountain, back down again to this side. And the blue one is the cut in this direction. What you immediately see is the momentum distribution curves are a much more user-friendly shape than EDCs. You don't have a Fermi distribution in momentum cutting that off for you. You have something which is more or less, but you can see it's not exactly the case, more or less a Lorentzian. And you can then easily, hand-waving with a ruler and a pencil if you like, just measure the half-width of this guy here and try and relate it then, for example, to the self-energy in the system. So I've actually, to make sure this movie doesn't take too long, thinned this data out. Both of these data sets are here, at least as every other spectrum has been removed in here as well. So here you see how the momentum and energy distributions go hand in hand. Of course, it's the same thing. The electronic states don't make a difference between energy and momentum. They move through what you could call K omega space happily. Yeah, just we've tended in the past to concentrate on omega space, and now we can move in K space in small steps. So this kind of thing, if you have a very high intense photon source, which also has a price tag, you can get something like this in about 5 minutes landing on detector, which probably would have been about half a PhD thesis in the old days. Okay, so an EDC, just to make clear, is then a cut in a vertical direction through such a stack of NDCs. So for particular momentum, we're looking at the energy dependence. So this is stuff I don't need bringing coals to Newcastle for you guys, but just to make sure, what we're actually after, of course, the holy grail for ARPANS is a spectral function. That contains lots of really meaty information that where we can discuss with each other about. But it's a real experiment that means that there are some things which separate you from this, from your goal. One of those, as I've shown, is of course the Fermi function. We can only look at occupied states with photon emission. The other thing is this matrix element here. So this is telling us the probability that we photoionize from a particular state with a particular energy with a particular K. And what comes into that, so this is the K of the photoelectrons, is the vector potential of the photon field. That's certainly within the sudden approximations. That's already quite a simplified picture. So the spectral function, of course, is the probability of removing an electron with energy E and wave vector K from the N electron interacting system. But we have to remember this matrix element is always present. So photon emission data will depend on the photon energy and on the polarization, for example. And that's nothing to do with this guy here. Spectral function doesn't give a damn what photon energy you use to look at it. But the matrix element does. So you can use systematic variation of your experimental knobs, like photon energy and polarization, to try and tell you whether the line shape you're taking very seriously in high TC physics is coming purely from the spectral function, or whether this guy's playing a game with you as well. And that's what I'll show you later on in the talk.
Well, Mark, there is also an intrinsic dependence of the spectral function on whether you are just at the surface or whether you are in the bulk. So the photon energy dependence might not be only a question of matrix element, right?
Sure. So this is assuming that you're really looking at the bulk spectral function. If you have surface states, for example, or surface reconstruction, then your electronic structure could be different in the surface near region. I'll show you in the system we're looking at here, which is BISCO, I think it's pretty certain that that's not a big problem. Though with some of the other high TCs, you have to be careful. And we've seen examples in the ruthenates, for example, where that also plays a role. So just to get you used to the way we show our data, unlike the string theorists, we're not in 17 or so dimensions, so we have to deal with how do we bring data over to people in two dimensions. So an EDC, of course, is intensity as a function of frequency. We can show it as a spectrum, or we can get rid of the intensity by showing it as a supermarket barcode, of course, in pretty colors. If you put a bunch of these EDCs next to each other, then you get an energy distribution map. So this is a map of photoelectron intensity, as a function of energy and as a function of 1k parameters, so ky. So we're dealing here always with kx and ky, the planar components of the wave vector. So if you like, you could say this shows us a band. This is like the EK band structure you can get from a computer, but here we're looking at it as a photoelectron intensity map. Of course, the matrix elements are in between us and what you calculate in a, for example, band structure calculation, as are the interactions, or a large part of them. So the other way is the momentum distribution. So this nice Lorentzian-like curve. So this is the intensity as a function of one of the momentum components, here, for example, ky, at fixed omega. So again, you can get rid of the y-axis of this curve into a color code. And so then what you have there is an MDC would be, for example, one such line in a collection of these MDCs, and that we give then the name MDM, momentum distribution map. So this is the photoemission intensity as a function of kx and ky for a particular omega. So it's a constant energy surface. And the way we do it is our spectrometer delivers us this bunch of an MDC for different frequencies. So we have a stack of these guys in frequency space. Let's call that going into the board. And we measure that for a particular angle. We rotate our sample, maybe 2 degrees. This guy moves. It's centered at the origin of the gamma point. This guy moves around like this, creating an arc of data. And then we move the second sample angle, and this analyzed area of k-space moves out to here and then goes around back again. So this is how you generate a momentum distribution map, because if you have energy equals to zero, omega equals to zero, and are sure you've controlled all the experimental artifacts, you may be allowed to call this a Fermi surface map. So what we have is such data like this, but it's going into the board, maybe 250 millivolts into the occupied side. And we can slice this up how we wish. So this sort of measurement, this is at room temperature from a Biscoe ITC. That takes about 8 or 9 hours in the system we have in Dresden. It has then an awful, awful amount of data in there. It's actually one of the problems is grad students drowning in data. So what I'm showing here is the raw signal, really the intensity that the detector thinks it felt, so the number of photoelectrons the detector thought it saw, as a function of kx and ky. And there's a lot of things I don't want to bore you with, which mean we have to be careful taking that signal literally to do physics with. And so a lot of the artifacts which are in there, like different parts of the detector, are differently sensitive to a photoelectron landing on them. You can get rid of that just by normalizing the data. So for example, if you divide this intensity from the Fermi level, either by the integrated intensity over the whole EDC, or you look at high binding energies where everything's more or less the same, just a flat background, you divide it out by that. Let's imagine one of the channels of your detector got hit very hard at some stage in a bad vacuum. It just becomes less sensitive. This intensity, of course, at high binding energies will feel that as well. So the whole thing will be a bit lower. So you just divide it through. And it doesn't matter which kind of division you do, as long as you pick one which is physically reasonable, you come up with the same kind of answer. So this is the raw intensity map. This is then an intensity map which has been normalized. And this kind of thing we would start to call a Fermi surface map. So what we have, and what we aim to use then, is a slice of cake. You have the band structure cake. I worked in Germany for many years. It's very important, of course, that you have whipped cream on top of the cake in large quantities. So the Schlagsahne is, of course, the Fermi surface, and that's on the top of our cake. But we can slice it in different ways we like. So at the top, there is a constant energy surface, so the momentum distribution map. We could slice down deeper in the cake. We can slice the cake in the other sides, and then we get energy distribution map. So here is the nodal band crossing the Fermi level. That gives, of course, a point on the Fermi surface. Here are the extended saddle point singularity in the other direction, which, of course, doesn't give you a signal on the Fermi surface. It just stops below the Fermi surface. So this is somewhere where you see very clearly the interaction between theory and experiment. What we're trying to get is a picture of the electronic states in as much detail as possible. And, of course, what's in there in this case, which in some cases is in here to a lesser degree, is the full interaction physics. So the comparison between the two, I think, is very interesting. So that's a quick run through photoemission as we can do it nowadays. Briefly, the Fermi surface, the definition of the Fermi surface topology. By topology, I mean, for example, is it hole-like or electron-like? And these are all sketches of Fermi surfaces put forward by really serious groups in the last 10 years or so, since I started my PhD till today. And you can see there's some quite significant differences between these. So you either have something centered at the corner of the Brouwer zone, so that's a hole like, and it's, let's say, a square with rounded corners. You have things which look a bit like that but are very strongly nested in different directions. You have this holy cross-like thing being suggested for some of the high TC, which should show us one-dimensionality in these systems. And the real wow a few years ago was a suggestion from a number of groups, mainly in the States, that you actually don't have only a hole-like Fermi surface, but you have a Fermi surface closed around the gamma point, so electron-like one.
Do these proposals all refer to the same amount of doping, or
roughly speaking? Roughly speaking.
Uh-huh.
This one is more suggested for the overdoping side, uh-huh. But roughly speaking, it's not like one of them is 2% and the other 20.
Uh-huh. Yeah? This is optimally doped.
Roughly speaking, yeah. Optimally, yeah. Let's say if you're talking about BISCO at least, then your doping range is quite limited anyway. You're talking from maybe 70 Kelvin underdoped to 70 Kelvin overdoped. That's all you've got to play with.
I mean, compared to the Fermi surfaces that people mapped out for normal transition metals in the 60s, this is a very trivial, simple Fermi surface. Yes, it's one sheet and it's two-dimensional. at the beginning of this field, there was a famous physicist who for many years propagated that there is no Fermi surface, as we all know. The BAM people got something in 88. Which looked very much like this. There might have been a pocket but you know. So I would tend to say that these, of course, these different shapes are significant and important and all of that. But on the background of many other things, they are fairly similar. Of course, we should be interested in these things, but that they are all fairly.
Sure, I would say the difference between this one and this one. I mean, that's real details. But I'd say the difference between this one and this one is quite qualitative.
Yeah, but that's not. Yeah.
Okay.
The area of this one,
well, I'll go on to show you that I very much agree with Ole that that's a bit of a storm in a teacup, and we've now come out of those rougher waters, and I think everyone's agreed again that it is what we saw originally and what the band structure guys have been telling us, similar to this one here. Wow. So we use BISCO mainly. Why do we use BISCO? Because it has a very nice cleavage plane. So between these bismuth oxygen planes, they're a long way apart, like graphite. You stick sellotape, taser film, I don't know what you call it in the States, on top of one of your crystals, and you peel it off in ultra-high vacuum. Sellotape is UHV compatible if you don't heat it too hard. And you get a mirror-smooth, atomically flat cleavage surface, okay, which is important for a surface-sensitive method. So it has an excellent cleavage surface. It is the best cleavage surface in the high TC. Problem is, though, that these bismuth oxygen planes, which are so friendly to part from each other without screaming too much when you pull on them, they're in fact modulated. They don't fit on the rest of the crystal structure very well. You can imagine them having a wave running along the crystallographic B direction. And what this does is it acts as a kind of diffraction grating. So we're doing photoemission from our buried copper oxygen plane. This is one of the reasons why we believe in BISCO. Certainly, we're looking at volume-like properties, because this copper oxygen plane has its stuff above it, at least half of what it normally would have above it. So it's not that the copper oxygen plane is suddenly seeing vacuum. So let's say we have a beam of photoelectrons leaving this copper oxygen plane at a particular angle. That means it was states of a particular momentum in the solid. They see this wibbly wobbly bismuth oxygen planes and they get scattered, so elastically scattered. So what we see when we look naively with our photoemission detector is a whole bunch of signals in angular space, which we then transfer into K-space, only one of which is real. Okay, so you have to be very careful about this when looking at pristine BISCO. And if you have some clever crystal-growing friends like Helmut Berger in Lausanne, they find out through their usual sort of black magic routes that if you put some lead into these bismuth oxygen planes, you can suppress this incommensurate modulation of the bismuth oxygen planes. And depending on the lead content and exactly who did it, you can get some other types of reconstructions. It's still not unbelievably simple, but there's really serious diffraction replicas you can get rid of that way. So let's show you. This is just a very badly focused photo of a lead picture, so low energy electron diffraction, so beam of electrons bouncing off single crystal of pristine BISCO. And what you see is a motorway of spots running along the crystallographic B direction, so gamma Y direction, and this is the incommensurate modulation of the bismuth oxygen planes. So rather than seeing four spots, roughly speaking, on a square, this stuff is very close to being tetragonal, what you see is a whole motorway of spots like this. What that means is when you do your photoemission intensity map as a function of kx and ky, the funny shape here is coming from the fact that this area here is what we measured, which is in fact much more than you need to measure. 45 degrees would be the minimum, but we want to correct for any angular aberrations in the system by measuring 180 degrees in azimuthal space, and you can flip it, make it bigger to make the point in the presentation. This is what it looks like if you do it for normal pristine BISCO, and 95% of all ARPA's work from the year dot till now has been done on this compound. So here you see clearly the main Fermi surface is a sort of rounded square centered at the corner of the Buran zone, but there's lots of other structures in there. So this is the main Fermi surface in blue. And there's another structure here, which you can see best, for example, around here, which we call the shadow Fermi surface. So I'll show that in green. So that's two structures. And there's also, let's go get those back again, things like this guy here, which looks like a copy of the main Fermi surface, shifted along this gamma y direction by 1/5 of the gamma y vector. And this is a diffraction of our photoelectrons from this cleavage surface. You can even see here, for example, the curvature in this direction, the diffraction replica of the shadow Fermi surface. So everything that's coming out of the copper-oxygen planes gets scattered, and because it's incommensurate, in principle, you have an infinite number of these guys sitting on top of your angular map of photoelectrons. So here I've just shown like plus or minus first order diffraction replicas, but just imagine having them, let's say, to 713th order, which isn't infinite, but it's lots of them. What you end up with in that case, is a big ribbon of high intensity running in this direction, because all of the edges of these different barrels overlap, giving you a ribbon of high intensity running along this direction. Nothing to do with the electronic states of BISCO, but everything to do with diffraction from these diffraction replicas. So you have high intensity ribbons as well. So put your lead in and you'll get less of a headache looking at this lead picture. It's much simpler. It's much closer to the one-by-one lead picture you'd expect from a tetragonal high TC. So these spots here are simply the one-by-one. These four, are the simple one-by-one lead pictures. There is a small amount of a C2x2-like reconstruction, but that's not important for the main Fermi surface.
Where does lead go into the sample?
It's surface sensitive, just like photo emission. So it's the crystal symmetry of the surface from which we're doing the spectroscopy.
So I mean lead, I'm sorry, I meant
the lead goes in the bismuth oxygen planes.
In the bismuth oxygen.
And helps them fit better onto the rest of the crystal structure. So if you measure then the lead dope system, that's the measured data. This is symmetrized to give us a larger area. If you want to make wallpaper or make yourself a tie, you can make it look even better. But what you see here is the main Fermi surface centered around the X point. And what's very remarkable here is the absence of all of these diffraction replicas. For example, in this direction here, the gamma y direction, you see really nothing on either side of the main Fermi surface. So this is the show view, main Fermi surface, shadow Fermi surface. Ooh, that shouldn't have happened. So that seems to be very clear for the lead dope system, that we basically have two main things. So I think this question of the Fermi surface topology is more or less sorted out. Let's go back to this map. As I told you at the beginning, we have data, of course, going in frequency space, so I can show you such a constant energy surface as we scan the frequency up and down. So it's a nice movie. I'll just show you that. So here you see the energy. That's the Fermi surface now. That's then above the Fermi surface, and it's going back down. So this is like a rigid band doping, if you like, if you just took the electronic states as we measure them and just move the chemical potential without changing anything else. This is what you'd see as your constant energy contour. Let me try and stop it here. That's more or less the Fermi surface I showed you already for the overdoped system. So rounded square barrel centered at the corner of the zone.
Where is the X point?
X point is here. Gamma point that's in the center.
Sorry, we should say this 45.
This is pi pi. Then I'll stop using it. This is pi pi. This is 0, 0. This is pi 0. This is 0 pi. Sorry, I apologize. Using letters is a bad idea. Sorry.
Okay.
So if we want to say let's underdope our system, we can of course look at the constant energy surface above the Fermi level. We're dealing with room temperature, so we still have intensity there. So that's here. You can see it's smaller. The barrel's got smaller. That's reasonable. Yeah. The area of this barrel, of course, should tell you something about the number of holes.
At which energy you reach the Van Hove point?
Well, let's go back again. It gets difficult because the normalization starts to break down. But let's say somewhere like this, they're getting pretty close together. Looks like a holy cross as well, doesn't it? But it's not actually the low energy. It's 100 millivolts. So the high energy physics may look like this. Also in Lansdowne-Coupe paper, the low energy physics doesn't.
What is the accuracy to identify where the Fermi level is? And then you just go look at the peaks, right?
The Fermi level itself at accuracy is maybe 1 millivolt. And that's very high.
By just looking at the peak? Or?
No, that's just, we have a sample and we have it in intimate electrical contact with a regular metal like gold, and we can just measure the Fermi Dirac distribution of the gold. We do it all the time to keep checking. And where the gold has its midpoint, that's the Fermi level of the system. Okay. For a metal. When you're dealing with the insulators, it gets a bit tricky.
But why does the y-axis look different than the x? Maybe is it just because I'm from the side here? Sorry, these look like long ovals rather than...
Yeah, they seem to expand out in this direction.
Well, they seem
indeed.
Higher than they are wide. Is that just my angle?
Maybe. Try and ask Gabriel what it looks like from there. Okay, so this.
Look the same, but they don't. Isn't it tetragonal?
Roughly speaking, almost. And it's not exactly tetragonal, but almost. And in terms of our accuracy, it is. I don't want to overstress this data. It's room temperature data, okay? So the spectra behind this are much broader than these sexy ones I showed you earlier on, but it's just to give you an idea.
It's not symmetrized.
It is symmetrized around here.
And the filling is still optimal doping around?
This is overdoped. And that's the bit that's actually at the bottom of the presentation. If you want to see it, I can do it for you later, the doping dependence.
This is the bonding
band? This is mainly the bonding band. I'll come to that in a moment. Okay, if you let me go on. Okay, thanks for the question, Sasha. What about the C-axis bilayer splitting? This is something where we have to say mea culpa to Ole and the other people. Of course, the band structure picture tells you quite correctly that if you put two copper oxygen planes close to each other, you should have a C-axis bilayer splitting. This was not seen by the ARPAS mafia for many years, and this was used to sort of hit the head of the band structure guys. Bad boy, something's missing. Now the ARPAS people have suddenly made the magical discovery that there's a bilayer splitting, and Ole is actually very gentlemanly about it, not always rubbing our noses in it, but we have to admit that finally we've come in line with reality on that one. So the question is, could the bilayer splitting explain these mysterious sightings of an electron-like Fermi surface? If you imagine a big bilayer splitting, a very high overdoping, maybe the antibonding Fermi surface has already crossed, the Van Hove singularity has already crossed the Fermi level. So this is what it may look like, for example. So you have two planes interacting closely together. You have a bonding and antibonding splitting. It depends on K, is zero along the 0, 0 pi pi direction, and is maximal along this direction here in K space. Well, this is a room temperature, so normal state Fermi surface map. The bilayer splitting is essentially invisible in there. You can see it as an increased width of the Fermi surface in general. You need to go down to low temperature, choose your photon energy correctly. Here I'm showing cuts in this direction in K space. So this is a constant energy surface. We now have momentum in one axis and energy in the other axis. And here you can see, even in a very highly overdoped sample, this is 70 Kelvin or less than 70 Kelvin TC, the antibonding band is still clearly dipping below the Fermi level here. If it was, of course, electron-like, it wouldn't be seen at all in this. It would be above the Fermi level if you're doing a cut like this, because it would say close around this kind of contour here. So even with the bilayer splitting, we are quite certain for the doping levels we're able to achieve, at least, that the antibonding band is also just dipping below the Fermi level. So you can do tight binding fits to this kind of data. This is a tight binding fit to the overdoped data. You can also do it to underdoped data. Here are the parameters you could compare them with band structure calculations.
Do you see the bilayer splitting in the underdoped materials or not?
Yes, come to that in a moment. So one question, 2PB or not 2PB, do it. Put lead in or at least look at both. Okay, you shouldn't be dogmatic and always stick with one or the other. But this guy gives you a very improved simplicity of your K-space, particularly around pi zero. When I'm coming on to peak dip humps, that's all happening at pi zero. And these diffraction replicas from the pristine BISCO, they sit on top of your pi zero point grinning at you, and you have to do something about them. Okay, so energy gap is the next thing. I'll just quickly go through some, maybe if you prefer the peak dip hump story, I could skip this. I mean, I can see that I'm running already a little bit late, but as you wish. Okay. So this is going to be from an underdoped sample. It's just the beginning of our program in this direction. But of course, if we now know we've finally seen the light, there's a bilayer splitting, you have to look to see what the superconducting energy gap is like on these different sheets of the Fermi surface. So up to now, it's been analyzed without taking the bilayer splitting into account. It doesn't mean that that data has to be wrong, but you have to go and check that what you thought then is still correct now. So we've done it from the lead dope system, because up to now it's been mostly done in the pristine BISCO. So what we're showing here is an energy distribution map. So we have, this is actually an angle that makes it a little bit easier for us to show, but this is basically this trace in K space here, then going into the board in energy. And what we're seeing here, this is an underdoped sample, here's a very clear bilayer splitting, here is the bonding band, here is the antibonding band. Of course, the antibonding band is much more spread out around the pi zero point here, or around the pi zero line, because it's underdoped.
So is this in this room
looking steady? This is at 40 Kelvin, yeah.
Okay, yeah. But do you see it above TC?
Yes, I'll come back to that later. Okay. You certainly won't see it if you sit too high in temperature. Everything just gets broadened too much. So this is an azimuthal cut on this azimuthal angle, so centered around the gamma point. And if we look at different EDCs, and we look here at very small differences in our angular position, so very small difference in our K position, we can get very different EDCs out of such a data set. We can either have a peak dip hump type of EDC, we can have ones with a single structure, and they're really very close together. In the old days, we couldn't have told those two apart, but if you look at the leading edges, which is what photoemission people usually use to quantify the gap, they're actually quite different. Okay, so you really have to be very careful to know where you are in K-space before you want to start saying about your map. And of course, if you're moving in dangerous territory, in rocky mountains with all kinds of gulfs, you need a map to tell you where to go. So we do the Fermi service map to tell us where the Fermi surface is in the normal state before we go down and look in the superconducting state. So how do we want to now use the full flexibility of photoemission with singleton radiation to find the best parameters to measure what we want to measure? So these again are azimuthal cut, but now I'm showing MDCs, momentum distribution curves. Okay, so energy is equal to the Fermi energy, and we're just looking at the intensity here of these guys, the bonding, antibonding, antibonding, bonding. Here we have 25 eV photon energy, here we have 21 eV, another 21 with a laboratory source which is non-polarized, 38 and 50. It doesn't matter to you what these numbers are, but what you can see is the bonding here on the outside and antibonding, their relative intensity varies very strongly with photon energy. So you should actually use this to select the right energy you want. So here, for example, at 38 eV, the bonding Fermi surfaces are very strong, whereas here, for example, at 50 eV, you hardly see them at all. So you have to do all this to check you know what's happening with your intensity, because you would like to link your intensity to the spectral function, not just to the matrix elements. So how to determine the gap? There are two ways of doing it. Of course, the nicest way would be to really have some analytical expression for the photoemission spectrum where the gap's in it. Best of luck trying to find one which everybody agrees about. Of course, the nice thing about that is you get the absolute gap value out. The worst thing about that is it's model dependent, and as an experimentalist, if you come with someone's model, someone else in the hall will kill you because they don't like that model and they prefer their own. So those kind of shark-infested waters we tend to just chicken out and stay away from. So you can measure the leading edge gap. So this means you have a photoemission spectrum, you look at the midpoint of the leading edge, what energy is this sitting at? And this only gives you a relative gap. You can't absolutely say this is the gap in so-and-so millielectron volts. It can give you the K dependence. For example, if you take the node as being zero, then you can track out the K dependence. And of course, it's highly precise. We can measure this to better than 1 millivolt precision. So for a leading edge gap, for example, you want then, of course, to be looking at the antibonding Fermi surface, and you want the bonding one behind you to be as small as possible. So you want the antibonding to be much larger than the bonding one, and so this kind of photon energy, like 25 eV, is a good one for this. You have very strong antibonding signal and very weak bonding signal. So that's what we'll use to look at the energy gap. So how do the gaps, firstly, between the two Fermi surface sheets compare, the bonding and antibonding sheet? So we'll look at this little bit of K-space here, which is marked in yellow. And this is now, it's in angles, excuse me for that, but it's roughly speaking in K-coordinates as well, but not the same shape. A map of the leading edge gaps. So the color scale or the gray scale here is the size of the leading edge gap. So here really doing a map showing the size of the leading edge binding energy. And what you can see, even though of course the bonding ones are very weak because we chose a photon energy to stress the antibonding ones, you can see the loci of the Fermi surfaces plotted out in terms of minimum gap. Loki. So that's actually, these black lines are the lines joining the points with the smallest gaps, and that's generally agreed with the photoemission guys and the theoreticians. That should be KF. So then what you can do is follow these minimum gap loci and look at the values of the leading edge gaps and plot them for these four curves. So you have the upper bonding and the lower bonding, the two red ones, and the upper antibonding and the lower antibonding, the two blue ones. You can just plot the leading edge gap in millivolts versus this angular coordinate, which is then this k coordinate here. Okay, so we're just around the antinodal direction, so of course we're not coming towards zero gaps. That would happen here along the node. We're just first checking to what extent these two sheets have different gaps. And what we see is they essentially, within the kind of error bars we have in the experiment, have essentially identical superconducting gaps, at least in this area of K-space.
So this is very different from the first reports from CX, yes? I mean, the first paper on this kind of thing would be
I would say it's important when you're doing this game to really be sure you have these diffraction replicas in control, because they're sitting on top of this whole area of K-space. So you need the lead doped systems. I haven't discussed this with him yet. This is quite new from us. I haven't had a chance to speak to him. So, okay, so now we are satisfied, at least in VAR data, in this K-space region, that the two sheets have the same gap. Now we want to look at the K-dependence in detail. So this is a rather warped version of the Fermi surface map, so it's the intensity from a 50 millivolt window at the Fermi level in angular space. That's why it's not looking like this nice quarter circle. It's this area of angular space. We're using now, on purpose, a laboratory light source which is not polarized, so that helps to suppress the very strong polarization-dependent selection rules which lead to very strong variations in intensity depending on where you are in K-space. So this is how you would put this wedge of K-space onto this angular map. And you can now draw again a map of the low leading edge gaps, and this is just for the antibonding part of the Fermi surface. So we've chosen a photon energy where we see essentially only the antibonding Fermi surface. So this is, again, the grayscale of the leading edge gaps, and the dotted line is the trace of the minimum gaps. So what we can now do, which is probably the thing you'll be waiting for, apologies you had to wait so long, is to plot the leading edge gap versus the angle on the Fermi surface. So by angle on the Fermi surface, we mean this angle here. We call the antinodal angle 0, and the nodal angle will be 45 degrees. What we see here is the leading edge gap, and we've plotted all of the gaps from this map, and of course, only the minimum gap is that at KF. If you go above KF, the leading edge moves back. If you go below KF, the leading edge moves back. So you see here this loci of minimum gaps maps out the leading edge gap K dependence. We're dealing here with an underdoped sample, and what we see, 77 Kelvin, is very clearly a deviation from the standard D wave. Standard D wave is this blue one here. It would be, for example, this kind of formula, and we're seeing a much more U-like gap.
In U, the scattering should smoothen this notch anyway.
Sorry?
In U, the scattering should make this notch smoother anyway.
Okay, that's certainly. And in the older data, you did see this kind of thing, but we haven't done this gap analysis for overdope, for example, where maybe it becomes sharper again, but you're quite right. Of course, impurities will lead to a smoothing out of this gap. Yeah. And this.
When you use this to determine the Fermi surface, I mean, there is no such thing, but you just say the leading edge moves towards whatever it is and then moves back again. At that certain point, you could sort of determine the Fermi surface. Is that consistent with the one you measured before, or does that change?
No, it's pretty consistent.
Perfectly, within the error, by the way, sure.
So when you're measuring at temperatures where the system's not gapped, here we're dealing with underdoped, so in principle we have to measure very high temperatures, everything's broad as hell. So your accuracy in K-space from a room temperature map is limited anyway. But all the groups agree that the minimum gap locus, if you're looking at leading edge, is a pretty good measure of the KF position as well. So this isn't new. This was seen already by Campuzano's group. John Mazod wrote a physio letter on that in 99. That was pristine 2212 and wasn't bilayer splitting resolved, but they also saw a significant shallowing out of the nodal area. So they saw, if you like, also U-like, but much less than here. So in fact, this is a case where when you do it all with the knowledge we have today, there's not qualitatively a different picture actually coming out. And they suggested the causes could be longer range pairing in underdog due to a reduction of the screening in the system. And so you have higher gap harmonics, for example, this cosine of the 6 times this Fermi surface angle would come in as the next higher harmonic. In their case, I think it was 12% was the largest contribution they had from this. In our data, you'd need to put in 27% of this higher harmonic. So it's preaching to the converted to tell you what this is connected to. It's the next nearest neighbor hopping and things like that. In a band structure, it'd be very nice to try and get a...
Okay. But at the node points, you see zero gap, not finite gap. Because it's your second class.
I told you the leading edge gap analysis doesn't give you the absolute gap. So to tell you with my hand in the fire that the node is zero, I need to have from one of you guys a real accurate analytical function for the line shape in ARPAS from a high TC superconductor.
Now, I mean, the simple explanation which I've been trying you guys and the tunnel guys for a long, long time is to say that we have to get the electrons up to the surface, and this matrix element is very big. To the first approximations, the electrons up in the Bisco plane are blind to the nodal direction. So how could you ever see a node? I had long discussions with the tunneling people on this, of course, who claim that they see a V-shaped node. Mm-hmm. And the sort of, what should I say, consensus we came to that, well, this matrix elements doesn't make electrons totally blind to the nodal direction. But I mean, what you now see is what you would expect from the simplest band structure. It's exactly the same symmetry as the perpendicular, as the Pythagorean splitting. Yeah. And that's what you would expect from very simple things that you published many, many years ago. But it's never been seen before in that clarity. And I don't know what the people really are.
Well, we have to, this is... When did this is now, yeah, it's now in press. I mean, we haven't received any screams from our colleagues here or in Japan, what the hell are you doing on the email? But that doesn't necessarily mean they like it or agree.
So the thing is simply that there is a filter which is cosine kx minus cosine ky squared, if you misuse it,
for example,
in front. Because
it'd be very nice to do the doping dependence of this. So this is really just one singular sample measured with an unparalleled precision, I would say. That's, but it would be good to do the doping dependence and look at the systematics.
Well, back to my question. Did you, definitely work calculations of dirty D-wave pairing, which have this U-shape. Did you try to compare?
We haven't tried anything. We've stayed very away from the shark fill waters of putting anything other than just a dotted line into this. We would like heavier weapons to do that. So if someone wants to come and do that with our data, fine. Just ask us.
I'm sure you would not.
And I see my job as experimentalist primarily of putting evidence on the table, and I'm wary of too quickly jumping into bed with one school or other about how you interpret that. Because usually you end up getting your fingers burnt and labeled as a stripe guy or a this guy or the other guy, and that's not necessarily helpful.
No, but recently Metzner showed us
yes.
Some calculations, and I think the delta he showed from his calculations looks more like your black dotted ones. And
yes, it's cited in our paper, actually, those calculations.
Yeah,
therefore.
Yeah. Well, I think D-wave means only the symmetry under C4, but not. It does not say that it must be cosine.
And in the meantime, the Dresden guys, Sasha Korjuk's done quite a detailed fitting of the... whether a leading edge gap of zero means that the real gap is also zero, and he's now quite convinced that that's the case. So he took basically a model spectral function which fits, for example, our nodal data very well, and did all of this kind of analysis of when can you trust the leading edge gap. So it seems to be quite a good one. So if you let me go on, or we can move it to tomorrow, you guys can decide.
I
don't want to preach to people who are exhausted or had enough, need a coffee. So now we come to the last bit about peaks, dips, and humps. You guys must be sick to the neck of peak, dips, and humps from photo emission people. I'll try and show you that it's an interesting story and it's important. So bear with the use of this jargon. I'll start with overdoped. So please remember that I'm now talking about overdoped 2212 based systems in the superconducting state. This is not overdoped. This is just a view that since I first knew high TC as a grad student, people have been getting nice papers in prestigious journals looking at peak dip hump at pi zero in high TC superconductors. So it started with Dan Dessau in CX's group in those days, and it's gone full circle through all the groups, people seeing it very clearly. The beginning was a real tour de force to see this at all in those days. My hat's off to the Stanford guys. And it's a question, what does this mean? that you have, at a particular point in K-space, a two-feature kind of spectral function, or two-feature kind of photoemission spectrum. You have a peak, a dip, and a hump. So it is, in fact, one of the seminal experimental results in the high TC canon. If you pick up any big review paper by theoreticians or experimentalists about high TC, the peak-dip hump will be in there. So generally speaking, peak-dip hump line shapes in ARPAs, if you're dealing with a single band or a single component spectral function, usually are interpreted in terms of coupling to, for example, bosonic modes. And the two bosonic modes that have been propagated in the high TC context is either the resonant magnetic mode seen in inelastic neutral scattering, pi pi, and that's very much been pushed from early days right through until today consistently by the Argonne group. And there's also suggestions, maybe in other portions of K-space, that you can see peak-dip hump-like structures coming from coupling of the electronic system to phonons. So these, of course, are quite important questions. What couples to the electrons and how much? So a brief potted history. There's a well-developed picture for the pi-pi mode as the origin of this, what I will call classic peak-dip hump. So that means at pi zero, just measured in any way you like with a particular photon energy. So Campuzano's group playing a big role. Theory from Mike Norman, from Abanov, Chubukov. It's really a well-established literature. I don't want to dredge you through it here, but it's there. We certainly don't want to say it's not there. So for example, here are calculations from Norman and Ding's paper in 98 showing that coupling to the pi-pi mode will result in a peaked imaginary part of the self-energy, which will in fact eat away spectral weight at the place of this dip. So a peak in the imaginary part of the self-energy here eats away spectral weight at the dip. So the important component of the peak-dip hump line shape is the peak and the dip within this kind of model. The hump is just what's left over when the dip finally recovers. So this is showing, for example, that you need not just superconductivity, but also coupling to this mode could give you this kind of thing. I'll point out that this is done before the bilayer splitting was rediscovered. So we carry on. The classic peak-dip hump then has become a cornerstone of the experimental evidence in favor of spin fluctuation scenario. It's always one of the things which is wheeled out as being in favor of a spin fluctuation scenario. There are, of course, a few people who don't want to have the spin fluctuation scenario. So the Key, Kibbleson, Epley wrote a paper where they said the strength of this pi-pi mode in neutron scattering, the spectral weight of it is never enough, A, to be the glue between any electrons in pairing, B, even to give kinks or peak-dip humps in photoemission or changes in optical conductivity. It's not even strong enough to mess around with the spectroscopy. So the importance of this mode has, of course, been doubted. And one can remark that up until this year, last year, all experimental data and models were done with your head in the sand that there's no bilayer splitting in the high TC. So, of course, as soon as you've seen the bilayer splitting, and a peak, a dip, and a hump has two features in your photoemission spectrum, a peak and a hump, for example, then you start to feel a bit funny. Yeah? Couldn't the hump be something to do with a second band rather than marvelous self-energy? So as the ZX's group, Dan Dessau's group, our group, we started to get a bit nervous about this. So let me just go through this quickly. The peak-dip hump is only seen, the classic one up to now, near pi zero, only in the superconducting state. In fact, it's only been seen in two-layer BISCO, which means the superconducting state is, in fact, always roughly the same temperature. It's not been seen in one-layer 2201 ARPAs in the superconducting state, interestingly enough. It didn't, in the early days, alter if Campuzano's group played with their polarization of their synchrotron radiation. So that was like a test, a good idea, to try and see whether the matrix elements were leading to this peak-dip hump. It didn't change, but the thing to notice there is all of the spectra published until we started recently, all published with the same kind of photon energy. So if, of course, you use the same recipe, you'll get the same cake at the end. So it's not surprising everybody agreed with each other. And we would make the point that the pi zero point of this modulated BISCO should be compared with the pi zero point of the lead dope BISCO, where you don't have these diffraction replicas. So that's, of course, this story again. So what we do is accurately locate pi zero from K-space map, measure EDCs from the superconducting state of pi zero in lead dope crystals, and we just take the synchrotron, all the photon energies it can give us, maintaining a very high energy and angular resolution. So we're trying to mess around with the matrix element as much as we can to try and see what spectral function, what is matrix element. So don't expect you to take all these data in, but here's a whole bunch of data from a strongly overdoped sample, so it's still overdoped here, 18 eV through to 65 eV photon energy. So let's pick some of the data out of this. So I call it a cafeteria line shape. You can select the line shape you wish to have. If you go to the old photon energies, you get the old peak dip hump. Okay, looks familiar. You can get ones without any dip. Yeah, why not? You can get ones without any dip and without a hump. And you can get ones without the peak. Yeah? So what made us nervous or worried was this is all from the same K point, from the same sample, from the same cleave. So you can't help but say that the line shape depends on photon energy. Okay? Everybody would agree with that. Well, the self-energy can't depend on photon energy. Self-energy doesn't give a damn what photons are hitting your crystal.
This dependence of photon energy, you also see that in the diagonal, or only in the 0 pi?
The diagonal, it changes intensity strongly, but there's no change in line shapes there. We haven't done such a detailed analysis yet. I would have to add to that. So you're forced with this data for the overdoped, strongly overdoped case, please remember that, we're forced to reject a single spectral function scenario for the peak dip hump. Classic peak dip hump, which I found so elegant, so it's out the window for this substance. Okay. Of course, you have to be careful if you're going to analyze the weight of this peak and call it a superconducting peak ratio and link it to the superfluid density, you watch out that you're always doing it at least with the same photon energy. Otherwise, you'll get some structure in there.
It doesn't follow from what you said that there is peak and the hump, because they just have different energy dependence.
Yeah, it's kind of, I'm probably being too, you're faster than I am. So of course the alternative is the peak and the hump are two different features, yeah, and they have two different cross sections. And it's obvious what they could be, anti-bonding and bonding combination of the two copper oxygen planes. Penny falls even for the experimentalist at the end. So we take a toy model, it really is a toy model. We take a spectral function number one, one peak, one band, spectral function number two, and a background. And we see how far we can come with our toy model in overdoped. 20 eV photons, we can get it perfectly. 25 eV, perfectly. 50 eV, perfectly. So peak, dip, hump, peak, no dip, no hump. We can fit that all just simply band structure.
So you assume some pitch new dependent mixing.
That's coming. There are photon energies where we admit it goes wrong. Okay? But we can fit most of them like this. It is a toy model, so I'm not going to fight with you about it. I'll just call it toy, and that means you can't kill me about the fact it doesn't meet. So what we do is we have a spectral function like this, which we take just from fitting the nodal data, for example. It has self-energies which are running like this here.
But that
we basically,
only one band.
Sorry?
This self-energy has only one band.
There's two bands. Here, band A and band B. Mm-hmm. Oh. And band A has its own matrix element. And band B has its own matrix element. Okay. So what we do...
And the Fermi function is actually...
Fermi function's in there, I mean...
Well, yes. It was strangely put in the first formula, but I guess...
They're experimentalist formulas, but it's... So what you actually see is we fitted, let's say, in detail one or two of these spectra, and then we just kept the spectral functions identical and just varied this pre-parameter, MA and MB. We call them the matrix elements, and we just let... The fit software only changed those two parameters, and we can fit the whole data set to this level of accuracy, at least. So these are then these matrix elements, so the prefactors before these toy spectral functions as a function of excitation energy. So the green one, we would say, is then coming from the bonding, and the blue one coming from the antibonding. So we can compare a toy model with big boys' models. This is state-of-the-art one-step photoemission calculations from Lindros and Bansil. They've done calculating on a band structure basis how the intensity, how the matrix element of the bonding and antibonding should vary as a function of photon energy. We just take our results of the toy model and compare them. We see a pretty good qualitative agreement. High photon energy, the bonding is winning. Low photon energy, the bonding is winning. In the middle, it's a more or less equal gain. So the message is in pi zero, in overdoped BISCO, the hump is due to the bonding band. The peak is due to the antibonding band, and the dip is just the space in between. Very sad day for fancy high TC physics, okay? The classic peak-dip hump was this marvelous cornerstone of the spin fluctuation scenario, but we can't have it for overdoped.
No, to be devil's advocate, in these fancy scenarios, there's no possibility to have different matrix elements or different independence.
It's coming now. Now the theory is now catching up with the experiment, the, you know, where people take two bands and do the coupling. Norman and Eshig have done this, for example. Of course, the big thing, if the underdoped situation is the same as the overdoped, then it's really looking pretty grim. Yeah, then off we go to the guillotine with the spin fluctuations. Well, I wouldn't be standing here smiling so broadly if that was the case, so you can tell what's coming. If you go to underdoped, it's important to do this again and see if you see the same kind of thing. It's very important. Whole bunch of photoemission spectra from pi zero of an underdoped sample now, as a function of all these photon energies. Yes, the line shape does depend on photon energy. Here the peak's very big, here the peak's very small. But the question is it really the same story as the overdoped? And the answer is no, it's not. Look carefully. There are subtle but crucial differences between these data sets. There's no spectrum here where there isn't a dip, or at least a plateau. Whereas in the overdoped case, you have these perfectly smooth single-component spectra. And if you do the toy model and fit this, you need then to fit it definitely with three components rather than two. And what you get out is one you could call then the bonding band, one you could call then the antibonding band, and you have the thing we just called the third feature. We don't want to give it a particular name. This is very limited in this toy model. But the third component clearly follows the antibonding band in its photoenergy dependence. If you put a third component in overdoped, it wobbles here and there and doesn't follow either of the others, probably meaning it's not actually that necessary. So one could think about having, for example, very simplistically, a bonding structure, an antibonding peak hump. You've got three structures in there, but that's at the level of our toy model. So the idea would be then to say, let's try and find just one of these bands. Let's just look at the antibonding band. If we think that the antibonding band has a second structure belonging to it, because its photoelectron cross-section, to call it that hand-waving, runs parallel to the antibonding band, let's find the photon energy from our drawer of photon energies, which switches off as much as we can the bonding band. This you can do here, and you can do here. So the bonding has a local minimum in both cases. 29 eV or 50 eV photons will show you a pure, in inverted commas, a quite pure antibonding spectrum. If we do it with overdoped, we see what we expect, a single smooth line shape. There is one antibonding band, that's it. If we do it in underdoped, we see a peak dip hump. And this is with photon energies tuned such that the bonding band does not show up. So we see a dip at least, or a plateau. So everyone can breathe out again. The antibonding band does seem to have an intrinsic peak dip hump at pi zero. Intrinsic meaning it's not coming from there being two bands, it's coming from being, for example, a glorious self-energy. So the peak-dip separation, which is generally a measure of the energy of the mode, is about 38 to 40 millielectron volts. Comes nicely in line, of course, with the pi-pi resonance. So let's look at this in a bit more detail. So here we're in the superconducting state in an underdoped sample, and we're cutting in this direction in k-space. So here is the 0, 0, pi-pi equivalent points, pi 0 in the middle. We're cutting across here. Just to show you what we're doing, this is first overdoped, okay? This is really just, let's say, the band structure case, if you wish. We have three different photon energies, 21, 38, and 50, and this one selects only the antibonding. You see just a single blob in the middle. This one selects both antibonding and bonding, and this one, the bonding band is much stronger. So here's the bonding band, and here's the antibonding. Okay, and you can analyze all this data. It's very new. We're still doing it, where the kinks are, all this kind of stuff. I don't want to go into that right now. Just look at the data for now. Now we go to underdoped, also below TC, with essentially the same photon energies. We see something which really looks quite nasty. I can understand why people look at underdoped and say, we don't see the bilayer splitting. And what are you going to see here? Where's the antibonding? Where's the bonding in this case? So let's zoom in on these two guys here and look at that in a bit more detail in the next sheet. So here the overdoped case, here is the antibonding band, here is the bonding band, so pi pi line is here. And here is the underdoped case. First point to make is the antibonding and bonding bands are not distinguishable in a simple way below TC in the underdoped system. What you also see is there's an area of energy, and this is really consistent in there, not just a function of which color scale we use to generate the plot, where spectral weight seems to have been eaten away, seems to have been wiped out. Of course, if you cross this plot in this direction to make an EDC, you will see a peak, a dip, and a hump. But this is now showing you a little bit of the K dependence on this, at least in the pi pi, pi minus pi direction, There's a whole wipeout zone where the spectral weight has been eaten away. And if you look at the energy separation between this wipeout and the low energy peak, it's about 40 millivolts again.
So, but there's no bilayer splitting here.
Well, you don't see it. It's underneath.
What do you mean it's underneath?
I'll show you in a moment.
Okay.
Yeah? So the overdoped case, you see very clearly. The underdoped case, probably the reason why people say we don't see bilayer splitting in underdoped. Yeah, sure, you can't really start. You can maybe imagine, yeah, this was the bonding band, and here somewhere maybe the antibonding band sitting. So below TC, it's pretty murky shark-filled waters with sharks eating away this intensity here.
Could you assume that matrix element is the same independent of the doping here?
We don't make any assumption about the matrix elements. We can, we have measured to answer that one. If you excuse me, I just go back to this. We measured them. Yeah, we fitted with our toy model, okay. We fitted in the underdog case how these things varied as a function of photon energy, and we chose our photon energies based on this plot. The basic, how this one runs and the overdoped one runs is similar. Come on, they're all copper oxygen plane states, so they're not going to have a radically different cross section. So, where was I? Let's get back. So, those two. So, this would be the energy of the mode, this 40 millivolts. So, what happens above TC in the underdoped case? So this is data I've shown you already, overdoped below TC, let's call it the band structure picture, if you like, clear bilayer splitting. There are kinks in there, so there are still coupling effects to be seen, but not on the scale that we see them here. Spectral wave's gone in that middle zone. Now we take the underdoped and we go just above TC. Looks like the band structure again. But just above TC in the underdoped, you see the bonding band and the antibonding band. A little bit less clearly, but this photon energy, but here the antibonding band, and here the bonding band. And with the 50 eV again, you just see the antibonding band. The wipeout has gone.
So
let's compare these two in detail. This is underdoped below TC and underdoped above TC. I will admit to you, they're slightly different photon energies. We didn't have the complete full data set that we would have liked to have. This is hindsight. You come back from the synchrotron, you say, shit, we didn't do the right photon energy. But this, we know from the photon energy dependence that we've seen, is not a really big problem. We have it now. We just have to analyze it. They're really two very different pictures here. From the same sample in the same area of K-space, one below TC, one above TC. So if this wipeout is due to coupling to a mode, it disappears above TC. Simple message. So if you're seeing this, of course, in these energy distribution maps, you should see it also in the EDCs. So an EDC is, of course, a cut through this line. We can look at the temperature dependence of the EDCs.
Sorry, shouldn't I have been seeing a gap or signs of a superconducting gap?
Yeah, sure, it's there. This is the gap.
What's pseudo?
Pseudo gap. Course here. Now, what do you want to call it? I mean, 120 Kelvin, it's the pseudo gap, and here we'll call it the superconducting gap. I mean, Harry and John, or call them both Philip. I don't mind.
Can you say that you have two gaps on your left panel, a smaller gap and antibonding band?
I wouldn't like gap. I wouldn't like to try and identify which of these is which band. Can you do that?
Yes.
No, above TC. Above.
Above TC.
Above TC, you can see as antibonding.
Oh, we would have to really look at.
Now, suppose that you introduce. Big gap in BB band and small gap in AB.
We would have to look at the leading edge. We'd have to look really at the leading edge energy. So a color plot is not the thing on which to see a gap. Because if one of these is more intense than the other, it will make it look as if it shifted away or towards the Fermi energy. So you'll have to be patient for us to get time to do that. And as I say, the gap data I showed you, that was underdoped. And there, at least around the pi zero point, there was no big difference between the two sheets. We should check that this new data set is consistent, quite right. So the temperature dependence now of the pi zero peak dip hump again. Overdoped, this is the band structure peak dip hump. And this doesn't care whether you're below TC, at TC, or above TC. Yeah, the bonding band doesn't disappear into thin air just because you've gone above TC. You can show it in a grayscale, there's always a peak dip hump. Underdoped case, you have a peak dip hump below TC. At TC, it's gone, just about, and above TC, it's certainly gone. So this is consistent with the energy distribution. So what are the fingerprints? Let's say we're now dealing with really the coupling of a mode. What are its fingerprints? It lives at 38, 40, so this kind of energy. Its strongest effects are close to the pi zero point, though it still exists in a region around that point. We're still mapping that region out. We haven't finished yet. It gives only significant sort of wipeout effects, at least, for T below TC. And the coupling is much stronger. In terms of the wipeout, it's really binary, on or off. Depending on whether you're strongly overdoped, it's not to be seen. And if you're underdoped, you see it. And you know where I'm going to go now. This fits like a glove, the pi-pi spin fluctuation mode. There's an additional piece of evidence coming out now that the theoreticians are, because we allow them to, that's not a criticism of the theoreticians, dealing now with both bands. One of the very nice things that comes out of the latest calculations from Matthias Eschlick and Mike Norman is that the scattering of the electrons via the pi-pi mode is odd with respect to the copper-oxygen plane bilayer. And that's something which is very specific for the pi-pi mode and wouldn't be the case, for example, for a phonon. And they were looking at data then, before this new data arrived, from Ziyech's group, Feng paper, and from Dan Dessau's group, where they were measuring kinks and things like that, and looking how to see at what K points you have, how much renormalization of which band, and they saw evidence for this odd behavior. So this all points to the pi-pi mode coming back into the game for the underdoped system. So if you like, this is my attempt a posteriori to apologize to Ole and the other guys, trying to make amends for the bashing the LDA guys got. So rehabilitating the bilayer splitting, it's not just a pain in the butt complication, certainly not. It's a marvelous tool, because we have this wipeout zone, yeah, where something is eating away our spectral weight. And the nice thing about the bilayer splitting is it gives you two probes of this. And of course, depending on the doping, it's a very, very hand-waving cartoon, overdoped, optimally doped, underdoped, which of your bilayer split bands is going to feel scattering from this mode is going to change. So you have a marvelous little laboratory to look at the coupling of the electrons which are really carrying superconductivity, to, for example, what looks to be the pi-pi neutron mode. So here, I think, coming back to the sort of theme of the workshop as a whole, you have the possibility of the real materials dependence of the band structure. We're measuring real crystals, and you know, there's a real TC difference between lanthanum cuprate and mercury one layer, and this has been captured nicely by the group work coming from the Stuttgart group. You have the doping dependence of the exact energy positions, the band structure of the bonding and antibonding, which you need as some kind of input. Either you just measure it, do your best, or it'll be nice to have it from theory. And you have things like this odd interband scattering channel that the pi-pi mode gives. So in this case, for example, the wipeout in the bonding band is so strong because the antibonding band has a huge density of states because it's sitting right at the Fermi level in the overdoped. So this odd channel means that you have a high density of states in antibonding, and that lets the sharks feed on the bonding band. And that's where we saw this big wipeout. So it's early days, but this is the kind of, you know, edging towards our holy grail. So just to show you, this is work coming from Ole Andersen's group. Correlation between the maximum TC and this range parameter, which can be connected to the T-T ratio of the bonding band of the multilayer. Now, it's interesting to look at this kind of business. Let's just say that the pi-pi mode is very important. Let's just for fun say it's the glue. The theories of Eschlick and Norman say that it couples in an anti-symmetric way. If you're the bonding band electron and you get scattered, the anti-bonding ones feel it. How does these play together? Yeah, this is an obvious trend, which I think everybody would be quite happy to say, fine, let's take that as red. Why is it the bonding one, and how does that play a role here as a function of doping, which of course is difficult to take into the band structure calculations in that way? So this would be a real challenge for realistic models then for the correlation with the doping in there as well, to try and connect these kind of things. Okay, shadow Fermi surface, that will have to wait till the next workshop. I think I've managed to be able to persuade you that it's worth spending that $1 million of taxpayers' money to do photo emission. We put in different crystals, different temperatures, all this kind of thing. We have to be good experimentalists and play with our experimental parameters. We shouldn't worry you with them, but we should use them to learn more about the physics. And what we've been getting out, at least today, was the Fermi surface shape, topology, things about the interactions of the system, as a function of K, of course, and things about the gaps. So I'd like to thank you for being so patient, and these guys again for their unmissable contribution.
Sorry, in the 2201, that's single layer 2201, isn't it? And you said one doesn't see peak dip pump in the underdoped?
No, that was, I think, if I remember correctly, that was overdoped material. Maybe I can find a picture. It was Takahashi's group did some very nice data. Of course, 2201 is pretty tough in terms of TC. So you need to really have all your resolution knobs screwed down very low temperature. Uh-huh. They had that. Let me try and find that. That's going to be in here, maybe. This is what I saved you from by cutting out lots of slides yesterday. Should be down here somewhere, I hope. Not seeing it. I can find a slide for you later. No. But at least it's not been measured with the intensity and lots of different people doing it than 2212. So maybe it's early to say that's a serious point. It's been measured in the superconducting state with extremely high energy resolution at pi zero, and there was no pronounced peak dip pump. And whether that's to do with crystal quality, all kinds of things, that's of course a question you can ask. We're still fighting. We're trying to cleave the thallium one layer. If that succeeds and we get nice data, of course, that's the dream system. But up to now, I see nice clean surfaces, but no dispersions. I haven't managed to get a single crystalline surface yet, but we're working on it. And there's not many sources. There's only one source in Russia of those crystals.
In your talk, you didn't say much about the self-energy, particularly imaginary part. Do you think it's not so reliable really to extract information on that? Or
Sure. You decide to do something and you have to stick to that. I mean, a competition is pretty stiff in the ARPA's game. So if you go around chasing everyone else's tails, then you'll never end up doing anything yourself. So of course, what we're going on to want to do and what other people do, I value very much. Looking at the self energies, what would be nice is to take this kind of data here. Oh, I don't want you to help me. No, it's working. Leave it alone, Bill. To take these kind of data here and to graft on top of this, for example, fits of the MDCs, where they are, to see kinks, for example. From these kinks, you can tell something about self-energies. From the widths of the MDCs themselves, you can say something about self-energies. You need very good data for that, but we have that, and other people too.
Essentially, your point is that
the question of how many grad students you have and how long they need to sleep. To work out all the data.
Yeah. In the past, there have been already all sorts of statements on self-energy. Do you think that these are, is there some consensus from the total emission community? For example, that at optimal doping, if you go to zero frequency, take the imaginary part, that there is some strong, still some imaginary part, which has a strong K dependence along the Fermi surface, these sorts of things.
Yeah, I think the broad lines are in agreement. When it starts to step over into an interpretation, what that might mean, then people start to diverge. Certainly, we're still a long way away, I must be frank, from having the kind of resolution where you can take the width of our EF MDC at the node and say that should agree with transport measurements, which of course it should at some stage in a nodal superconductor. So we're still a bit away, but that's a good approach and it should be done. I mean, one should just, as a theoretician, always be a bit wary of just taking the numbers. I mean, you know, that's why we're a bit nervous of doing it, because people take away our numbers and you'll get hit with them later, or someone else will have different numbers and it'll generate a virtual fight that's not really there. That's why at the moment, because this data is very fresh, we're not putting numbers on it, coupling strengths and this kind of stuff. That could be quite dangerous, exactly how you got them. So at the moment, we prefer just to show the data. I mean, everyone will see that there's something missing here that's not missing over there. So that's the qualitative picture at the moment.
Would it be right if I sharpen your statement and say that any attempt to extract self-energy from a bilayer compound measurement without taking into account what is leading is wrong?
If you want to be rigorously Russian, then you're right. It's not wrong, it just has more structure in it than what you think. If you analyze it, I mean, this old Fermi surface doping dependence we published a year ago, that was room temperature data with no bilayer splitting, and we talked about the width of the Fermi surface as a function of Fermi surface angle, and yeah, the bilayer splitting sitting in there. So it's not wrong, you just have to be aware that it's in there. But I say, of course, what we need to do, and that's what we're all doing, all the groups, is doing it bilayer splitting resolved. Either find yourself a one-layer compound that works, find yourself a two-layer compound, do it well enough with the photon energies that you can select out. Underdoping still remains a problem because everything's much broader, generally speaking. Yeah? So this is much more washed out than the overdope case. So it's more difficult to, with a good conscience, say I can separate the two components. But you should bilayer split, bilayer resolve it, of course.
You have the corresponding data on the diagonal?
No, not with me, no. We haven't done so much in the diagonal. This was all synchrotron data with a certain geometry of measuring, which means we're very good at making these cuts between pi, pi, and pi minus pi. And with that symmetry of the geometry experiment, we can't do anything in diagonals. We've got much less diagonal data. So it's a question, of course, there is, CX sees a peak dip pump in the diagonal. There is, in any case, a kink in the diagonal. Everybody agrees about that. It's interesting, is that the same reason of the kink that's so big here that you can hardly see it anymore, or is it something else? I find a little bit to say in that direction in K-space it's phonons, in that direction it's something else. I find it rather, I mean, okay, the quantum mechanics we're used to double think, but that's maybe more double think than necessary.
Just coming back to this K-dependent of self-energy. Yeah. This full interpretation of self-energy was done with bilayer compound, or there is some data with single.
There is from CX's group paper in Feng's paper where they were remaining above TC because I don't think they wanted to kill the holy cow of the peak hump at that stage. Some statements about the anisotropy around the Fermi surface of the bilayer split resolved MDC widths. And the answer was it's much less anisotropic than we've thought up to now. But it's much more like one layer, for example, where pi zero is much less broad compared with the pi pi line. And in the two layer. So that becomes reasonable again. Why should the one and two layer disagree other than with bilayer splitting being hidden in one?
But did Mike Norman reconsider this? To
I'm sure he's busy with it.
But he did long time show this bilayer and
calculation.
A year ago, I think Cordier and you were occupied with this doping dependence on the Fermi surface.
Yeah.
That was the first thing you said. And I tried to ask you to compare this with the energy dependence and say the simplest possible with the band picture that you could have and ask how did that compare. Yes, I mean, you have the energy dependence, you have the doping
dependence.
Yeah. You know, getting out some energy effects is something different. Now came the bilayer splitting and all this detailed new analysis. Are you going back to the actual work now on trying to?
That's a manpower problem, if I'm really frank. I mean, Sasha has been working on all this stuff, and I don't know whether, I hope he sent you the data or the picture I'm trying to find now. So this is at least a paper of Sasha's, actually about how to determine gaps, but to be able to do that, he fitted the data for at least one overdoped, one underdoped, and there you see the energy dependence, if you like, and to how many, whether it was only fitted to the experiment at zero, or whether he did it at other energies, I would have to ask him. I wasn't involved in writing his paper, so. It's not forgotten, but it's a competition for people's time. But, you know, I think one of the reasons why that got put a little bit on the back burner is that certainly the self-energy part you're talking about gets killed by Igor's argument. You know, it's room temperature data, the bilayer splitting's in there, but we can't see it. So let's not kill ourselves analyzing the width of this thing. So as soon as my instrument's running in Amsterdam, this is the kind of things you can do very well with a laboratory instrument, doing all that stuff at low temperatures, trying to resolve it.
Experimentally, I mean, one of the nice things I see is that getting rid of this shadowing effect and this lead doping. Now, is actually the way the shadowing and the lead, what these things are doing, the same for underdoped and overdoped samples and the same for all the temperatures you're looking at?
Well, there's certainly a distinction to be made. between, in pristine bisque there are three things, and in lead dope there are two things. In pristine bisque, what there is, which is on top of this, are what I call these diffraction replicas. I wouldn't confuse that necessarily with the shadow foamy surface. Now there is something here, which has been dubbed the shadow foamy surface, and the jury is still out as to what the cause of that really is. Yeah? So that could be antiferromagnetic spin fluctuations, but then the problem is here we're sitting at overdoped, we're sitting at room temperature, why the hell are they so strong? So maybe that's a structural, still a structural origin. Bernard Keimer tells me they're finding structural peaks in neutron scattering with the C2x2 type of symmetry. So that's still a question which we're looking at. So what we're trying to do with the lead dope system with different lead contents is looking with different photon energies, different temperatures, different dopings, trying to find systematics of how this guy varies with respect to this guy. Whether this is in fact a diffraction copy of this one, or whether it's really electronic states in their own right.
There's no temperature dependence of this thing between 30 and 120.
Not very strongly. I mean, it's already there, and this is room temperature, and it's quite, you know, this has always been the worrying thing. If it's short-range antiferromagnetism, what the hell is it doing there overdoped at 300 Kelvin?
Okay, maybe we can mark again. Oh, you have a question?
No, I was going to